Good evening, Truth Seekers. Welcome to the program. I'm Mike Malloy. Thanks for tuning in. Stick around tonight, okay? This is we're very close to the anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie, and we're going to mention that a little bit later on in the program tonight. It was March 16th, 2003, when she was run over by an Israeli bulldozer as she was standing in protest in front of the house of a Palestinian that was about to be demolished. We'll get to that a little bit later tonight. Also, the Obama administration said today it is abandoning the use in court proceedings of the Bush administration's term enemy combatant, as the Obama administration argued for the continued detention of prisoners at Guantanamo, Cuba, which I guess symbolically separates itself from Bush detention policies. But in a filing in federal court, the Justice Department, the Barack Obama Justice Department, argued that the president does have expansive authority to detain terror suspects there without criminal charges, much as the Bush administration asserted. And according to New York Times Online, the Justice Department, the Barack Obama Justice Department, provided a broad definition of those who can be held, signaling that as long as Guantanamo remains open, the new administration will aggressively defend its ability to hold some detainees there. The filing in federal district court in Washington bitterly disappointed critics of Guantanamo, the Times says, who said it seemed to continue the policies they had criticized for more than 7 years. It was the latest example of the Obama administration assuming ownership of Guantanamo, even while moving quickly to close the prison where 241 men remain. Well, I'm sure there's a method to the madness, right? Obama does have a plan, right? I mean, he can't handle everything at once, right? Oh, and by the way, China's leader says he is worried. China's leader says he's worried about the safety of China's $1 trillion investment in American government debt, you know, U.S. Treasury bonds. China happens to be the largest holder of this debt, and the Chinese government is urging the Obama administration to offer assurances that the securities would maintain their value. Don't do this to us. Oh, really? Well, just so happens Prairie 2 has something to say about that. Our economic affairs correspondent, Prairie 2, writes, China's dragon is hungry. The Chinese premier, Comrade Wen Jiabao, said in a press conference that he's worried about China's investment in U.S. treasuries and wants assurances from President Obama that China will someday get its money back. Oh, really? But he wouldn't say that they have any intention, the Chinese, of not buying more bonds, nor would Mr. Wen Jiabao say what he wants in the way of assurances. His comments may have been intended for domestic consumption, as the Chinese government appears to be trying to disengage from the U.S. economy without creating a panic at home. They already have more than 20 million newly unemployed workers, and this could lead to widespread unrest unless Comrade Wen can convince his public that this is the fault of reckless behavior on the part of the Bush crime family and not China's They seem to expect the U.S. to produce more of its goods at home, and that going forward, China will export less and depend on domestic consumption for growth. China is also moving into third world economies in an even more aggressive way, while the U.S. flounders. The captains of the universe, the masters of the universe that run the U.S.-based multinational corporations that are accustomed to looting and pillaging the rest of the world may find themselves to be little more than dragon food. P.S. on Crazy Karate Chuck Norris. I do believe under the Patriot Act that just having knowledge of a terrorist cell is a felony. The kind that allows the president to hold you as an enemy combatant. Whoops, we don't use that anymore. Forever. The Supreme Court recently dismissed as moot an appeal of a lower court ruling that made this the law of the land. Of course, they could take up the appeal again if Chuck would like to spend a few years in the Navy brig being tortured while his case goes through the courts. After all, as a good Republican, he wouldn't expect to be treated differently under the law, or does he know that Obama would never act like a Republican, so he's free to shoot off his mouth? Prairie 2. Yeah, Chuck Norris is really, he's lost it. I hate to talk about, crazy actors who decide they want some time in the limelight. And then people like I give it to them. So I just won't. You know, I have a question. I want to ask the global capitalists who have wrecked the world, and really wrecked it. I've spent the better part of this afternoon reading some stuff online and in Mother Jones and in The Nation and a few other magazines, some firsthand accounts of what's happening in places like Detroit and Cleveland and cities in Indiana and upstate New York like Buffalo, and some of these first-person accounts and pictures from neighborhoods with houses very similar to the one I grew up in, boarded up. Houses in Cleveland selling for $500. Houses. Of course, the sidebar to that is who would want to buy them. But I just wonder, I've spent the better part of the day reading this stuff, and I want to ask the global capitalists who have wrecked the world a question. Will you stop now? God damn it. I mean, will you? Can you just leave the planet alone? Can you just leave us alone? You know, you have absolutely broken the earth. I was reading a report today, a thousand climatologists and earth scientists are meeting, somewhere in Europe. And they are exchanging papers that have been written over the past couple, 3 years based on science, real science, not on Limbaugh's garbage in the House and the Senate, or the leader of the Republican Party himself, Rush Limbaugh's drug-addled screaming on radio, but real science. And the picture, the outlook for planet Earth, Malloy laughed into his microphone, is not very positive, uplifting, promising, unless something's done today. And, of course, nothing, as far as I know, was done today. I don't know. Maybe something was done today. I have no idea what was done today. But unless something was done today, we're in a world of world hurt, literally speaking. And I just wonder, will the people who wrecked the planet, can you stop now? I don't care if you're American or from the UK or Chinese. I really don't care anymore. Just a simple plea from somebody who lives here and who has kids and grandkids. Can you just leave the planet alone? Can you just leave us alone? Have you not done enough goddamn damage to all of us in the past 300 years? Can all you capitalist pigs just please stop? I don't know what you think is going to happen to you. You may be able to live a little bit longer than the rest of us. You may think that you're going to survive the whole thing in your deep earth bunkers, but I don't think you are. I'm just curious. Can you just leave us alone now? Have you done enough damage? The IMF, the World Bank, NAFTA, all these so-called neoliberal economic policies have only served the rich and powerful. The rest of us, we'll just take a look at the wreckage piling up, huh?
Get your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. So, yeah, in reading all this stuff today, also in the New York Times, about how children are being really hit and hit hard globally. Of course, this is nothing new, but it's getting worse now because the capitalists have wrecked what little bit was dribbling down to kids in sub-Saharan Africa, to children all over the India now has this tremendous, or has had, and that's what was featured in the New York Times today, this tremendous problem of undernourished children. And you know, you read that kind of stuff and you think, well why? I mean, why is there not a couple of very key things going on with the human race that should have been started, say, well, I don't know, maybe 30 years ago. And I say 30 because I'm thinking about birth control for men and for women. Population control and taking care that those of us who are around 30 years ago, which was about what, four and a half billion, an enormous number, but the planet was still able to sustain it, that population, if things would have been done differently. But you know, population control, and to make sure that everybody on Earth had nutritional input that was adequate, if not beyond adequate, to sustaining life, and therefore cutting down on disease. And then, you know, I started thinking one step further. What about control of diseases that are very easy to control with very little amount of money? Infant diarrhea that kills millions of children around the planet every year. Malaria, you know, stuff like that. I remember one time Limbaugh did a program about how Rachel Carson was responsible for more death on this planet than Adolf Hitler. And his warped, sick, degenerate, drug-addled reasoning was that when Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, and that resulted in pulling DDT off the market where it concerned keeping bugs off our food, that the unintended consequence was that all of a sudden millions of people were dying in tropical areas because there was no longer DDT to control the mosquito population. Of course, the flaw in that kind of logic is so big you could drive something as huge as Rush Limbaugh through it, but, you know, why bother explaining it to the bobbleheads? You already know it, and so do I. But, you know, reading all this stuff today, you know, and I started thinking, wow, the entire world has drifted either willingly or unwillingly into a form of state capitalism, a blend of capitalism and fascism that has absolutely, utterly wrecked this little blue dot, as it has been referred to from one of those photographs taken from out in space, this little blue dot. And I just wonder why that is. And I'm old enough to not ask those sorts of questions. I mean, I expect a question like that from a 12-year-old. But from a person my age, it's a little bit embarrassing. And I sat there today with the New York Times in one hand, the web under my fingertips going from this piece to that piece. I'm sitting there thinking, how did this happen? And then the question came up, you know, asking the global capitalists who have wrecked the world, Are you going to stop now? Are you going to stop at all? I mean, how far are you going to push the planet and everybody here? Why aren't the global capitalists all of a sudden focused on saving the planet so they can continue their exploitation, but at least still have air to breathe and food to eat? Because for those who think that because of the accumulated wealth that they've stashed away someplace, they're going to be spared, you got to be kidding, right? Of course, I guess you do think that. That you can build some kind of a disaster-proof home in the Rocky Mountains or the Himalayas or someplace, and you're going to escape. If you do escape, you'll have to stay in your cave forever, because if you ever come out, the survivors who didn't have that kind of a place to stay will grab you and strip your flesh from your bones and eat you. So what have you gained? But when you think about the IMF and the World Bank, and as you look back over the history of those organizations, what they were about, oh, my God. Oh, my God. When you look at what NAFTA was about and how it was sold to us, and the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, the GATT Agreement, all this stuff, all these so-called neoliberal economic policies that really were designed to serve the rich, not in the slightest to elevate the conditions of the poor and the wretched. That's how it was sold, but that was never the intent. The intent strictly was to serve the rich and powerful. And so the rest of us can take a look at the wreckage piling up and scratch our heads and look at pictures of once working class neighborhoods in Cleveland or children in India and just kind of stand back and say, you know, how in the world did this happen? Wow.
It's hot in December, cold in July. When it rains, it pours out of a poisonous sky. In California, the body counts keep getting higher. It's evil out there, man. That state is always on fire. Everyone has a system, but they can't seem to win. Even Bob Geldof looks alarmingly thin. I've got to get on that shuttle, get me out of this place. But there's gonna be warfare up there in outer space. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? It's getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on
It's about 25 before the hour. Rachel Eileen Corey was an American member of the International Solidarity Movement who traveled to Gaza during the Second Intifada. She was killed on March 16, 2003, by a bulldozer operated by the Israel Defense Forces during a protest against the destruction of Palestinian homes by the IDF in the Gaza Strip. I was not present in Rafah that terrible day, March 16th, 2003, but I have frequently replayed in my mind the events leading up to the moment when a bulldozer rolled over Rachel Corey. I think to myself, what compelled this young woman, neither Jewish nor Palestinian, to travel 10,000 miles from home, throw in her lot with a family not her own, a people not her own, and ultimately meet a death that came suddenly, swiftly, in an instant of shocked comprehension? In the biblical book of Ruth, we read of Naomi, whose two sons have died, leaving two young widows. Naomi encourages her daughters-in-law to remain in Moab, their own land. One daughter-in-law kisses Naomi and bids her farewell. The other, Ruth, chooses to accompany Naomi to the distant climes of Judah. Why does Ruth go? Entreat me not to leave thee, says Ruth, for Whither thou goest, I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. And she continues, where thou diest, I will die. And there I will be buried. The biblical figure of Ruth journeys to her new people, expecting never to return, but to be buried in foreign soil. The modern figure of Rachel Corrie journeyed to her new people, expecting to return for the start of the school year and never to be buried, or to be buried at some vastly distant, unimaginable future, but never to find her death in the soil of her chosen destination. She journeyed to her new people, expecting to find another culture, another language, another way of interacting, but never to find another attitude toward the taking of life. She journeyed expecting to see death, but never to be embraced by it herself. In Fear and Trembling, Kierkegaard recounts the story of Abraham as he takes his son Isaac to be sacrificed on Mount Moriah. The story is so unfathomable. How could Abraham take his son, his only son, and prepare to slay him for no apparent reason other than God's inscrutable request? Kierkegaard constructs several scenarios of what may have been coursing through Abraham's heart as he walked his son to Moriah to kill him. Kierkegaard writes, "It was early in the morning. Abraham rose betimes. He embraced Sarah, the bride of his old age, and Sarah kissed Isaac, who had taken away her reproach, who was her pride, her hope for all time. So they rode on in silence along the way, and Abraham's glance was fixed upon the ground until the fourth day, when he lifted up his eyes and saw afar off Mount Moriah. But his glance turned again to the ground. Silently he laid the wood in order. He bound Isaac. In silence he drew the knife. Then he saw the ram which God had prepared. Then he offered that and returned home. From that time on, Abraham became old. He could not forget that God had required this of him. Isaac throve as before, but Abraham's eyes were darkened, and he knew joy no more." In my mind's eye, when I see Rachel standing on that mound of earth and facing the bulldozer, I envision a young woman looking at the small window fast approaching her in the brow of the bulldozer, peering into that dark space to find the eyes of the soldier who was driving, perhaps someone her own age, someone who also loved to dance and joke with a younger sister, someone who was thinking about how long it would take until he could finish this job and get back to the base, where he didn't have to face the anger of people who didn't understand what he's doing, thinking about his weekend pass and his own future, and maybe he would go back to school and finish that course, or about his own loneliness and how it is to be out there alone at the gears every day. And then there's this girl out there, and why doesn't she get out of the way? What was his next thought? Shall I kill her? Or I'll scare her, she'll move. Or still time to break, as he hurtles forward. In this land where blood pours down like lemon drops and sticks to all the senses, to paraphrase Joni Mitchell, we cannot know what thought compelled this young man to push on. Later that day he may have wept and found comfort among his friends. He may have shrugged it off. A dirty job, but someone's got to do it. But we do know one thing. He will live with the death of Rachel Corrie for the rest of his life. He may not read every article about her. He may agree only with those who justify his deed. But we know that he reads some of what is written. And we know that he thinks about that day and wonders if things somehow could have ended differently. How do we know this? We know because we agree with Rachel, who risked her life in the belief that whoever was driving that vehicle would stop before he harmed her. We know because we believe, like Rachel, in the fundamental decency of every human being, and that even those who kill harbor pain in their hearts for that death. We do not have to forgive this man or this system that led him to kill in order to understand that the trauma of Rachel's death, which affected millions of people throughout the world, also affected the man who took her life. On that blindingly sunny day in Rafa, when optimism glints irrationally from every tank, every M16, every dog tag on the necks of 18-year-olds in uniform, photos of loved ones in their pockets, Rachel stood her ground with ease, waiting for his eyes to meet hers, waiting for decency to slow the grinding treads, waiting for the moment of sanity to kick in, to interrupt the flow of tension swelling toward collision, waiting for the inevitable to happen, that reason would prevail. Today we are some distance from that moment. We have had time to think about it, and still we are no more capable of fathoming what transpired. that until the moment of impact, Rachel never lost her faith in the decency of the bulldozer driver, that until the moment of impact, the driver never understood that he was capable of this terrible crime. Writes Kierkegaard, "It was a quiet evening when Abraham rode out alone, and he rode to Mount Moriah. He threw himself upon his face. He prayed God to forgive him his sin, that he had been willing to offer Isaac, that the father had forgotten his duty toward the son." In my own efforts to understand these terrible deeds, the one on Mount Moriah and the one in Rapha, I asked myself, at Mount Moriah, what was the more terrible, that Abraham had been willing to sacrifice his son or that God had demanded this of him? And in Rapha, who's the real sinner, the soldier who ended the life of a girl on a mound of earth in a land not his and not hers, a land where Rachel, like Ruth, was invited and welcomed, but he was an interloper and resented? Or in Rapha, too, is the real sinner the God who had demanded this of him, God the army officers, God the brutal policies, God the society of those willing to inflict pain on others to still their own hearts and traumas? And whose gaze turned from one of trust to astonished alarm? The driver, who trusted that Rachel would leap away before it was too late, or Rachel, who trusted that the driver would halt the vehicle one tread sooner? Ever more relevant is Season of the Chamomile by the late Palestinian poet Samir Rantisi, written in 1988, soon after the killing of an Israeli and a Palestinian near the village of Beita. An excerpt. How many more ordinary mornings will fill us with horror and transform my day to another sky? Who chose us to be the victims and the symbol, to be the beginning of the beginnings, the moment of historical trial? We, the two dreamers, the routine, the ordinary, who chose us to be the heart of the conflict and the crossroads of time? Why didn't you find someone besides me to be a symbol? Why didn't you find someone besides you to be a victim? Why could they only find Beita in the spring? Our hearts in grief, we ask, why didn't they find someone besides you to be a victim? Why didn't they find someone besides you to be a symbol? Ah, Rachel, ah, unknown soldier, why could you only find Rapha in the spring? Was written by Gila Sivirsky. Gila Sivirsky is co-chair, along with Professor David Kretzmer, of B'Tselem, the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And when I read that today, I was just knocked down. Just knocked down. And you can find that at commondreams.org. Commondreams.org. It's there. And as a sidebar to that story, an American demonstrator was critically wounded today in a clash between protesters and Israeli troops over Israel's West Bank separation barrier. Peace activists with the International Solidarity Movement, the same movement to which Rachel Corrie belonged, said Tristan Anderson of Oakland, California, was struck in the head with a tear gas canister fired by Israeli troops. Orly Levy, a spokeswoman at the hospital, said he's in critical condition, anesthetized, and on a ventilator. She described Anderson's condition as life-threatening.
by monkey-free fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. Why is it all right for our country to go trillions of dollars into debt for Iraq and Afghanistan? But it's not okay to have that kind of debt to try to save the United States. Isn't that what we're hearing from these right-wing thugs, from the Limbots? Wouldn't you be glad when John Boehner finally gets a chance to go away? Oh, my God. Little more news that we hear via a couple of websites and our one of our close advisors to the program, Bridget Wolf, who writes, Mike, Peter B. Collins has been my choice for the afternoon slot since Randy went off the air this time. He announced today that he's throwing in the towel. He will do his show for one more week, and that will be the end of it. Christ, Mike, there has to be some way to put stable funding in place for voices that at least half the country want to hear, or would want to hear if they ever had a chance to hear them in the first place, to make that choice. Progressive talk radio is one of the few sources for real information anymore, other than Comedy Central, of course. I don't know if there's really a chance to restore democracy in this country, but I can guarantee you that without progressive voices on the air, there won't be. I think the silencing of voices like Peter's, and God forbid yours, frighten me more than anything else. Bridget. Yeah, I hadn't heard about that until Bridget sent me the email. But then I noticed there's a thread about it at Democratic Underground, and I think also at Liberal Talk Radio, LTR. Peter and I worked together at, IE America, Kathy. He was syndicated on IE America the same time we were.
I believe way back in the early day, and also, interestingly enough, he preceded you on WLS in Chicago.
Oh, really?
By about a decade, but he got his start as a nighttime talk show host on WLS.
Peter Werby also was on the old IE America radio network. Peter,
as was Tom Hartman.
Oh, Tom Hartman was. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Tom was on IE America, too. Peter B. Collins is thrown in the towel. Werby does weekends, and Hartman and I are now self-syndicating. So it's a weird commentary. And for you right-wingers that are getting ready, you Limbaughs, to send me an email and say, well, that's because the market says we don't want you. Don't. Okay. I've seen that garbage so many times. You don't have a clue as to what you're talking about. Well, you never do. But it really is a shame that the liberal establishment, and by that I mean the liberals that have tons of money, even now, there are rich liberals. Believe it or not, there are mega rich liberals. There are liberals who are worth billions, hundreds of millions, tens of millions, a few million. And not once has one of them stepped up to the plate with the begging and the pleading. They won't now. For assistance. They won't fund think tanks. They won't fund websites that put out blast faxes that contain the truth after one of these right-wing sludge holes issues another press release based in lies and garbage. This is one of the reasons I really, truly hate the liberal establishment. I really do. Individual liberals? No, of course not. Individual progressives? Yeah, you know, great stuff. But I have watched so many programs, including my own, going all the way back to the mid-90s here in Atlanta, when I tried to maintain in radio after I was fired by WSB to make way for Dr. Laura. And I started buying time on a local radio station here in Atlanta. This is how I met John Sinton, who eventually went on to be the first president of Air America. And Sinton helped me. Or made an effort to help me. There was only so much he could do to stay on the air. And I think I stayed on the air for about, what was it, Kathy, about 2 months, because that's when you and I met. But I can remember towards the end of that tenure, begging and pleading for the labor establishment, for the Lawyers Guild, for any liberal group, for wealthy liberals here in Atlanta, and they do exist. You know, please, just keep, I'm not asking you to pay my salary, I'm just asking you to pay the time. I think it cost $150 an hour to lease the time on this radio station. And not one of these sons of bitches would step forward. Not 1. Whereas the right, you know, not Ted Turner, you know, everybody thinks Turner's a great liberal. Well, he may be a political liberal, but as far as assisting in keeping progressive voices on the air, I guess Turner, like a lot of liberals, has said to hell with it and just turned their backs on us. Okay, you know, so be it. Some of us will continue to struggle with this. But it's a damn shame. Anytime you hear some right wing pissant tell you that the market is determined, what's on radio and television, either he's convinced he can continue to fill your head with nonsense, or he doesn't know himself. So or she doesn't know, whatever. But anyway, getting that news today that Peter B. Collins is ending his struggle. When I think about the liberal talent. Bob Kincaid is another example at Head On Radio who has struggled. And you know, I'm not going to name them all. I don't want to bore you with the list of names. But there have been some real talent. There has been some real talent that has held on with their fingertips, their fingernails, trying to get out the liberal slash progressive voice. Somebody like Amy Goodman, who has been busting her chops for how long now on Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio, and then to Link TV. You know, you would think that somebody like Amy Goodman would get a mainstream media gig if she wanted one. But I mean, look, let me take a look. So it's I don't know. We, and by we I mean Kathy and I, are starting this Malloy thing, and I swear to God, we will somehow keep it going as long as we can. I think our prospects are pretty good, especially in this nighttime slot that we're in. If I didn't think our prospects were good, I wouldn't be doing this because our resources are very limited. But, you know, once again, the liberal establishment in this country that has money has just said, I'm too busy. Hope you make it. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy program. Regarding the incident today at near the West Bank separation barrier that the Israelis put up. The Israelis say this event today took place in the West Bank town of Na'alin, where Palestinians and international backers frequently gather to demonstrate against the barrier. Israel says the barrier is necessary to keep Palestinian attackers from infiltrating into Israel. But Palestinians view it as a thinly veiled land grab because it juts into the West Bank at multiple points. Now, the Israeli military says the area where the protests take place is a closed military zone. It's off limits to demonstrations, period. So about 400 protesters turned out today, according to the IDF, and some of them threw rocks at the troops who responded with riot gear to put a stop to that. That's what the military said about stopping the rock throwing. Ulrika Jensen, who is with the International Solidarity Movement, said troops, IDF troops fired tear gas canisters into the crowd from the hill above. she said, quote, Tristan, the young man that was grievously wounded, apparently. Tristan was hit and fell to the ground. She said he had a large hole in the front of his head and his brain was visible. Pow! Man, I'll tell you. I don't know. That was the same organization, of course, Solidarity, International Solidarity, Solidarity Movement that Rachel Corey was involved with. So 3 days short of... 3 days short of 6 years ago. You know, it looks like another American. Tristan Anderson is from Oakland, California area. It looks like another American young person demonstrating for the rights of the Palestinian people is in a bad condition tonight. Joe in Tucson writes, Mike, we've allowed the conservatives to hijack and misinterpret our view, or my view, he writes, of socialism. What they're really saying is that a socialist form of government will allow the average person to have a say in what the government does, and that the average person will benefit from the government and its policies instead of the conservative form of government in which only the very, very rich are represented and everyone else gets to pick up their crumbs. Another thing that bothers me, would the Madoff scandal have been such a big deal if it had been just average Joes who got ripped off? I honestly doubt it. Joe in Tucson. You can compare it to the savings and loan scandal during Bush 1 and... what happened there? Bernie Madoff's name will go down in history. I defy you to name one person involved, other than the guy in, see, I can't think of his name, the guy that McCain was involved with in Arizona. What, or not in Arizona, but what was that banker's name, Kathy? Do you remember? No, that was Enron. Well, I'm sure 80 people sent me an email. I hate these senior moments. Well, I don't think it's a senior moment. I think it's just trying to carry so much crap inside my skull. It's not going to work. But anyway, it's very difficult to remember the players. Jeb Bush was involved, or not Jeb Bush, but one of the other Bushes was involved. See, I can't even remember his first name either. In the SNL scandals of the late 80s, that just wiped out. I mean, completely wiped out a whole lot of common folk, not the big players like Madoff wiped out and the big foundations. The SNL scandal wiped out. So many people who had worked all their lives for wages and who had invested, had saved, had put their money in SNLs, and when it all tanked, Keating, thank you. The Keating Five, there you go. Thank you, Rob. When that happened, do you still remember how much they said it was going to cost the American taxpayer over the next 20 or 30 years to pay back? Well, we're only, 20 years removed from that, and obviously we're still paying for it, because the government at the time, the Bush 1 government, decided, oh, well, they're too big to fail. So Resolution Trust Authority, wasn't RTA, Resolution Trust Authority, was set up in order to buy the toxic SNLs. But nobody paid any attention. I remember seeing a little bit of coverage, mostly on CNN back in the day, or maybe it wasn't even CNN. Maybe it was, well, I think it was CNN. I don't think the networks paid any attention to it. There was no MSNBC back then. There was no Fox. Older folks wringing their hands, standing in front of closed SNLs, freaked out, totally just devoured by fear. God only knows how many people died of heart attacks or suicide when it became clear that they had been totally scammed in the failure of the SNLs. So Here we are 20 years later, and it's happening again, only this time these rapacious son of a bitches have decided to loot the entire world. And Bernie Madoff, who really, if you put Madoff into perspective, he's an ant in a stampede of dinosaurs. I mean, so ooh, whoop-de-doo. Bernie Madoff ripped off $60 billion. You know, $1 billion just ain't what it used to be anymore, right? And $60 billion, okay, yeah. But my emailer is right here. If it wouldn't have been for the fact that people like Elie Wiesel, and his family and all the charitable organizations that he, tried to support with his investments, and the list goes on and on. The shocking thing, I mean this, shocking, is that Madoff made it a point to rip off members of his own tribe. I mean, this would be like, Catholic priests, buggering little boys. Oh, wait a minute, that happened. Oh, that's true. Madoff ripped off other wealthy Jewish people globally, in addition to institutions, but those were his primary targets. And somebody sent me an email the other day, a Jewish friend, that said, you know, Malloy, it's a good thing he didn't rip off the Gentiles, or they would have asked for the death penalty. The fact that he ripped off other Jews is one of the reasons, perhaps, that this thing is getting the kind of vocal attention. People who invested heavily with this guy because they trusted him, they believed him, and he took advantage of that. You know, today when I watched the video of his walking into the courthouse to be sentenced, and that downtrodden look on his face, you know, I felt a momentary wave of sympathy for him. Until then, you know, even though no cameras were allowed in court, afterwards, when people outside the courtroom, having heard what he'd been, that he'd been remanded to, he hadn't been sentenced yet, but he went in today to enter his plea, and then he was remanded to the custody of a jail in New York, or what, the Manhattan House of Detention or something. And people outside were cheering when they heard that. Then it occurred to me, yeah, these people have had everything stolen from them, every single thing taken from them. But, yeah, my emailer's right. If it had happened to common folk, I doubt if we would have heard very much about it. Oh, and Neil Bush is the one I was looking for. Thanks to Paul and Roz and Reggie and Rob and Joe and everybody who sent in the names that I just couldn't recall. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Was always having dirt to play around me. Starched white shirts, you will find bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play around
Conservatives, don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
Oops. Sorry about that. Well, see, if the rich liberals would respond accordingly, I wouldn't clear my throat into an open mic. It's all their fault! All right, we're going to open our phone line so you can call. And I think, is it Tuesday night, Kathy, the AT&T has sworn, an oath, you know, they screwed up, all these phones should have been working, what's today, Friday, yesterday, but because it's AT&T and they can't find their ass with both hands and nobody there has the competency, you know, a Stone Age, what? Don't say that.
AT&T, if you would like to advertise with the Malloy Show, please disregard the following 30 seconds and only listen to me.
we love AT&T.
No, we don't. We hate
AT&T.
No, we hate them. We hate them. I probably wouldn't allow an AT&T ad on this program. God, what am I saying? No, it's very frustrating. It really is. You know, I shouldn't say I've been through all this, but Kathy this time had to go through it. You know, press one for this, press two for that. By the time they get up to press 19, you're ready to pull out a gun and start shooting. When you finally get a human being, it's somebody from Bangalore, you know. Hello, may I help you? Yeah, I'm having trouble getting my phone lines in. What the phone lines are you talking? You know, I mean, it's just Oh, would I do it again? Oh, I don't give a damn. It's just absolutely ridiculous. Why are call centers for American customers in India? Okay, that's idiotic question number three for this evening. I understand, but it's ridiculous. You know, why not move all the auto mechanics to India? And then you see, cool, if you want to have your car repaired because, you know, the 4 years are up and you're ready to buy a new car, but you can't afford it anymore. So you want to have your car repaired. What do you do? Well, just ship it to India, you know, and I'm sure somebody there will be more than happy to fix it for you. This is crazy. The job done on us has been so swift and so sickening and so complete. And here we are. With how many millions of people out of work? I mean, state after state, you see these statistics. It's the worst it's been in 20 years, and then 30, and then 40. And now all of a sudden, it's worse since we've been keeping records. And now it's the worst since the Great Depression. I mean, how much worse can it get? Well, according to the people who are scaring the bejesus out of me and probably scaring the bejesus out of you, it can and will get much worse before it ever turns the corner. But that can't happen. Because as it gets worse, scum like Chuck Norris starts oozing out from under the rocks and say, well, let's arm ourselves. And there's thousands of cells in America ready to fight. Fight whom, you dumb bastard? Where were you when they were hijacking the Constitution and starting two wars, you gutless bastard? Where were you then, Chucky? And the rest of you people that, you know, oh, well, we're back running around in our camos, in our camis again, because there's a Democrat in office. Yeah, it's his fault. Jesus, God. It's incredible. Well, I don't know how to respond to it. I really don't. Anyway, there was a little tiny piece on the editorial page of the New York Times today about this deranged 28-year-old gunman in Alabama who killed 10 people this week, wounded 6 others, then shot himself. Now, as the Times says, in a sane world, this bloody rampage would at last persuade Congress to reinstate the national assault weapons ban that it let expire in 2004. But this is not a sane world. We don't live in a sane world. We live in the United States of America, where the National Rifle Association is the second most powerful lobby in America. And what the NRA wants, the NRA gets. It's like the AIPAC, like the Israeli lobby. What the NRA wants, it will get, no matter what. You know, it doesn't make any difference. Somebody could march into the downtown section of any major city in America with three or four of his friends. And I say his because it's always some sick, usually deranged white male. And with three or four of his friends armed, as well armed as any Marine platoon, and they can open fire and kill 150 people. And you know the goddamn IR or NRA would still say, well, we don't need any kind of gun laws. Guns don't kill people. Deranged Republicans can kill people. We're never going to wake up, are we, huh?
All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night.
Now a soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against this order, from the sirens night and day, of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
I don't think so, Leonard. I think I had it shot. It's about 25 before the hour. Coming up the bottom of the next hour, we're going to have a moment with Bob, which we haven't had for a long time. So stick around for that. Anyway, back to this little quick write-up on the op-ed or the editorial page of the New York Times today about this poor deranged sucker, this 28-year-old now dead gunman in Alabama who took a military-style semi-automatic assault rifles and wiped out 10 people, wounded 6 others before he finally turned his weapon on himself. And as the Times says, in a sane world, this bloody rampage would at least persuade Congress to reinstate in tightened form the national assault weapons ban that it let expire in 2004. But it's not a sane world, at least not where the laws are made in this country, where the NRA still has, like I said, they're still the second most powerful. Or, you know, it's a foot race between AIPAC and the NRA. But here's an example. In February, the Senate approved an amendment that would abolish not only an assault weapons ban, you know, get rid of it. Anybody have anything? But other gun control laws already on the books in the District of Columbia, including reasonable rules on gun registration and trigger locks. These sons of bitches don't even want trigger locks. Keep these weapons out, especially in D.C. where the Negroes can kill each other. Ha, ha, ha! That's a knee slapper! As the Times says, this dangerous provision was attached to an overdue bill that would give the District of Columbia a voting member in the House of Representatives. That was the bill. And the amendment would abolish not only the ban on assault weapons, but gun control laws already on the books in Washington, D.C., including the rules on gun registration and trigger locks. Trigger locks. Trigger locks. And as the Times says, the NRA has now moved its formidable lobbying campaign to the House of Representatives. Steny Hoyer, the Democratic Majority Leader, said last week that he did not have the votes to bring the D.C. bill to the floor without opening the possibility that the weapons amendment would be added. So, Steny Hoyer has had to withdraw a bill that would give the District of Columbia a voting member in the House of Representatives. Not like the current, again, don't email me because I'm just so frustrated about not being able to remember these names, but the woman who has been a non-voting representative from D.C. for so long. What? No. Steny Hoyer can't bring the vote to the floor because it has this filthy, degenerate amendment attached to it that will wipe out all the reasonable gun laws in Washington, D.C. and also wipe out an assault weapons ban. This is insane. This is insane. The Times then says, Of course, that was before the murders in Alabama. At this sad point, surely, Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi ought to be able to muster enough votes to stand up to the gun lobby and its threat to the safety and democratic rights of the citizens of the nation's capital. Surely they can provide that leadership. Well, the New York Times is being sarcastic there, because the answer is no, they cannot. Either they cannot or they will not, Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi. What they will do is piss around with this bill and put it off and then do this and then do that. And then some night at 2 o'clock in the morning, the D.C. representative bill will pass and the amendment will still be there. And they'll all get their checks from the NRA, all the Democrats and certainly the Republicans or the Limbots. And they will all go home patting each other on the back. Well, we got the check. We got the money. It's unbelievable, isn't it? No, I guess not. Trigger locks. There was an effort to tag ammunition. Just tag ammunition. So the slaughter could go on, but it would be easier to track down where the weaponry came from. Oh, what a weird idea. That sounds like homicide investigation work, but no. Not even a bullet tagging. Nothing. Nothing. And this goddamned NRA, this sick bunch of degenerate thugs who insist on having a population that is armed to the teeth with military-style assault weapons. Oh, I know what you're going to say. Yeah, but Mike, what happens when the fascists take over? Look, the fascists took over a long time ago, okay? And the only time there's been a gun grab has been from a Republican administration. These right-wing sons of bitches, led by this jerkwater Chuck Norris, well, there's thousands of cells in the United States, and we're ready to go. Really? Are you really? You cowardly little creep. Where were you when the country really was being ripped to pieces? Eleanor Holmes Norton. Thanks, Reg. That's the woman who has forever been the non-voting rep from D.C. But I backtrack. Well, I have to backtrack. You know, I backtrack all the time. I'll tell you what. Let's do a phone call. Michael is calling from New York City, listening on the Internet. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm fine. I haven't called for a long time, but a crazy schedule. I just found out that you're no longer with Nova M. And,
hey, we're not, Michael, we're not with anybody. We're not with Air America.
Right.
We're
now
not
you're self-syndicated.
We're not with Nova M. We're not with On Second Thought. We're not with ABC. We're not,
I hear you.
The list of who we're not with is endless. it's just us, pal.
I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Boy, that sounds rough. First of all, before I move on, I just wanted to express my support. You, of course, as you know, you got the top rating for best liberal talk show host, right?
At liberal LTR, Liberal Talk Radio website. Yeah. And I appreciate that. The people online listeners voted that. Watch out. Here, close your windows quick. Here they come, Michael.
That's right.
Yeah, Liberal Talk Radio had that listener poll, and that was great. We really thought that was cool. Now, if somebody would look at that, some rich liberal, and say, well, let's send the Malloys $100,000 so they can stay on the air. But you know how that goes, right?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it didn't work that way.
No, it doesn't.
Well, in any case, boy, I'm sure glad at least you're still on the air. It seems as if it's kind of like the situation around the time of the American Revolution, where everybody was setting up their own printing press. I mean, what the blogs seem to be, you know.
That's what the blogosphere is. That's right. Yeah.
And so you're the sort of the on the air equivalent of that.
Just about. That's a good way to put it. I think we're going to be okay though, because there's an awful lot of support for this program, and at some point, We're going to be letting our listeners and advertisers and everybody know, okay, this is what has to be done if you want this program to continue. And I think it'll happen. I really do.
Yeah, well, I'll definitely keep my fingers crossed.
Thank you.
You were talking about various things. You were talking about Israel. I thought I might mention an excellent website I've recently found called Annie's Letters.
Annie?
Annie, as in ANNIES-letters.blogspot.com. Excellent for, a compilation of various news reports from independent sources and then various mainstream media around the world on the situation in Gaza, the West Bank, et cetera.
Annie's Letters. -letters.blogspot.com.
Right.
Okay.
That's up there. Juan Cole does excellent reporting, but I'm sure you know about him.
Right. I'm still here. Go ahead.
Hello. Sorry. Of course, talking about the economic crisis, the question I have is really, and it's something I've been thinking about for quite a while, is whether, and I'm sure a lot of people have been thinking about this, whether we're really in the kind of crisis that is just going to sweep everything away.
Hey, do you want to hold on a minute, Michael?
Sure, no problem.
All right, because we got to take a break here. Let me put you on hold, and we'll come back and pick you up after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us.
Well, the sun gets bloody and the sun goes down ever since the water moon. And the lights come up on the Blackfoot town. Somebody said, what's the better thing to do? Well, it's not just me and it's not just you. This is all around the world. Over the mountains, down in the valley, lives the former talk show host. Far and wide, his name was known. He said, there's no doubt.
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, we're talking with Michael, who is in New York listening via the Internet. All right, Michael, where were we?
I was just asking a question whether... the crisis that we're experiencing is really something that's going to sweep everything away as we know it, or whether, we'll eventually recover. I'm sure that's on a lot of people's minds. People think about the Great Depression. I mean, at times it seems there are sort of existential crises of capitalism. The Great Depression of the 30s was one of them. I mean, maybe now we're in that kind of crisis. It really takes a tremendous amount of work to get out of it. If it's not now, will it happen later? I mean, it seems as if, I remember 10, 20 years ago, people would have said, oh, no, the Great Depression could never happen again because we have all these controls. We have all these,
Well, yeah, but if I can jump in because we're coming up on top of the hour here.
Sure.
In the first place, I think capitalism, as we've come to know it in this country and as the world has come to know it, is dead. I mean, it is. It's had a 300-year run. It worked most efficiently when it had slaves to provide free labor. It's over. I think what has to take its place is a form of what I call democratic socialism. A lot of real socialists would probably listen to my plan and kind of giggle and hoot and slap their knees. But to me, five or six key industries in this country have to be totally nationalized. I don't mean this lickety-split way that Barack Obama's doing it. I mean completely nationalized.
Yeah.
And it has to be done quickly. probably more quickly than Obama can use his cut and paste method. But once these five or six key industries are nationalized, then open up with a series of government sponsored lending institution or banks, whatever you want to call them, so that entrepreneurs, small businesses, don't small businesses provide 50 or 60% of jobs in this country anyway? And aren't the small businesses the ones that are really taken on the chin here? So make that kind of small business entrepreneurship the underpinning, where the jobs are created, where people can make a living, where people can open up a store. When I was a kid growing up, half the kids in my fifth grade class had parents who were in business for themselves and they lived over the store. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Kathy and I are doing exactly that now. We have a business. We have, it's a home-based studio. We live over the store. So that to me is the answer. Global capitalism is dead, and it's dragging down. It's destroyed the planet. It's destroyed how many lives? Pick a number. I mean, how many lives? Tens of millions? Hundreds of millions of people who, and I mean destroyed their lives. They're dead because of the actions of global capitalism. So it's over, and it took the collapse of the U.S. banking system, the U.S. financial system, the U.S. economy, to finally drive the point home. Now, there are a lot of people in this country who just don't see it that way, who are in business, who are in industry, who are in government, don't see it that way. But, man, I'll tell you, Michael, we are on the verge of either wake up and change this system or don't wake up and let the nightmare continue, and this country is going to wind up looking like Botswana.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm afraid of, really, basically. I'm afraid that we could have a complete collapse of capitalism, and instead of socialism, or something.
Well, yeah,
like
yeah.
What you're talking about, we could have some kind of
fascism,
you know,
sure.
Military dictatorship.
Well, absolutely.
Basically guaranteed, you know, I mean, the army can produce whatever it needs.
That's
right.
Right. That's right. So
basically, I mean, that would be the model of our economic system.
Absolutely. It's
with,
a real,
you know, a few small businesses here and there.
It's a real crapshoot right now as to which system is going to come out of this collapse. Is it going to be democratic socialism, or is it going to be a military form of fascism? The last administration, and to a lesser degree the current administration in this country, I think is anticipating the latter. I don't think they have the courage to move this country to democratic socialism, and I think any attempt to do that, even though this is desperately what we need, I think the right-wing nutballs in this country who have the guns will make an effort to stop it. People like Limbaugh and Norris and Glenn Beck and these people, it would be a definite call to arms. And then the so-called liberals and the so-called progressives are not going to sit by and let this happen, and this country is going to convulse into a bloodbath that's going to make the American Revolution look like a Sunday school picnic. So we're on the cusp of something here really horrifying, Michael, as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to see my culture, my society, and whatever, you know, this culture is a hybridization. There is no such thing as American culture. It's been influenced by so many immigrant groups. That's who we are. It's an immigrant country. And
that,
I don't.
That helps us to be divided. I mean,
well, it may, but
to a certain extent, it's what's allowed a lot of businesses to divide us as much as they have.
Well,
you know,
we need
Irish against Italian.
Right, I understand.
German, Polish, whatever you name it.
I understand, but if that doesn't stop, and if we don't. To me, that tapestry of immigrants in this country has been the only thing that made this country worthwhile. We don't have any collective history. Our history goes back 230 years. I'm talking about white people's history, and African Americans who were dragged here. That history. I'm not talking about Native Americans. We don't have a history. You know, there are cities in Canada older than this whole damn country. So, what do we got? We got this tapestry that was put together by immigrants, and, I'd like to see it continue. I'd like to see a switch to a human face, a humanistic form of government. And I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. Hey, listen, pal, I'm out of time. I got to go. Okay.
Great talking to you, Mike.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you checking in, Michael. Take care. We have a break. We shall return. In about half an hour from now, you're going to hear A Moment with Bob. Welcome back. It is, what time is it? About 7 past the hour here in the east. I guess it's 7 past the hour in the west, too. This is the Molloy program. We have one open line here, which is the totality of the lines we have available until Tuesday night, and then we'll be back in business. So if you want to call in, the number is 877-99-MALLOY, 877-99-MALLOY, 877-99-MALLOY. That was Kathy's idea, not mine. I would have preferred 877-EACH. Well, you know. But 877-99-MALLOY. So if you're the first one through and your call is phone worthy, you will make it on the air. I don't want to get hung up on this topic necessarily tonight, because we've talked about so many times about how progressive radio is left to twist slowly in the wind thanks to all the rich liberals. The rich conservatives make sure that their story, as neo-fascist as it is, gets out all over the place. But listen to this. This is from Justine, who writes from Maryland. Hi, Mike. Many thanks to you and Kathy for your tenacity to press on despite the many strikes against progressive talk. Well, those are nice things to say, but you know I don't do that too much on the air. So let me skip down. Like so many others, I'm very saddened to hear that Peter B. Collins is signing off, and I'm frustrated with how the industry has completely dumped on progressive talk and talkers, ignored listeners, and refused to acknowledge good ratings in multiple markets. When Redskins owner Dan Snyder dropped Washington, D.C.'s only progressive talk station a few weeks ago, we were left with a three-hour block of Ed Schultz, parentheses, I know, on one of three conservative stations in the area, and a one-hour block of Democracy Now! On our local Pacifica station. Sadly, the Pacifica station no longer runs much political talk, in contrast to more vibrant programming in prior years. I don't want to knock the station. I've supported it for a long time and love the hours of jazz and international music it now airs throughout the day and weekend, but am disappointed in its more recent direction. On the plus side, there is Radio 1 AM station in the greater Washington, D.C. area that airs, among others, Joe Madison and Al Sharpton weekdays. However, consistent with progressive talk around the country, the station is on a very weak signal. I can only hear it at home in the wee hours of the morning. So now, Justine writes, in the allegedly most powerful city in the world, we are bombarded by the likes of Hannity, Limbaugh, Wiener Savage, Beck, Ingram, and even lower-tier conservative talkers like Fred Thompson and Monica Crowley, who, yes, has her own show. However, save for a few measly hours here and there, there is no alternative voice. In the several final months of the now defunct sole progressive talk station in D.C., it was not possible to call, write, or contact anyone associated with the station until the last couple of weeks before its demise. Believe me, I tried, mostly to let them know there was support for progressive talk. But perhaps that's why the station was being made, being able to contact them so unsurmountable. They didn't want to know supporters existed. Anyone who still buys into the mantra of supply and demand is either a fool and has had his or her head buried in the sand for the past decade, or is a lying conservative bot. Please know that we support you and will stick by you for as long as you are up to the task. Justine in Maryland. And you know, we here on the Molloy program, all both of us and that clutch of people who provide so much creative energy into this program, I name their names every night. I appreciate that, and we will stick around as long as we can. You know what really pisses me off, though, is that even though there is a lot of support via the podcast subscription list and so on and so forth, essentially what I'm talking about, though, and I think most people know this, I honestly think we'll get enough support to keep this program going once we get cranked up here and the new website up and so on and so forth. But you know what I'm talking about. Historically, wealthy liberals have just turned their back on the two areas that they have made a grievous error in turning their back on. And that is A, progressive or liberal think tanks that could, get speakers out, get op-ed pieces published in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. they have failed miserably at this, and two, providing liberal media outlets. You take somebody like Rupert Murdoch, an arch conservative, more like a proto Nazi, come to think of it, and he puts a goddamn television network together, for heaven's sake, and then starts buying up Wall Street Journal, New York Post, television stations all over the country, on and on and on. And the equivalent, I don't know who the equivalent in this country would be in terms of money, but you take someone like Michael Moore, and God, I'm so sorry to pick on Michael Moore. I really am. But let's just take his name for an example. Michael Moore is a multi-millionaire at this point. Other than the blog site that he has, what form of media is Michael Moore supporting? Who else? I can't pick on anyone like Oprah or, some of the more well-known people that one assumes to be liberal because I don't know what their political point of view is. But there are enough wealthy liberals in this country to have mounted a counterattack, against the neo-Nazi right that has been going on in this country since Barry Goldwater got his ass handed to him in 1964. That's when the decision was made. And the first clear result of all that money and all that effort that the right wing poured into our political system was the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. So it only took them 16 years. That's all it took. And in that period of time, all the think tanks that were put together, all the media outlets that were purchased, all the efforts that were made to paint Ronald Reagan as some kind of a saint. And what was Ronald Reagan really when you get down to it? He was a spy for the FBI against his own union, the Actors Guild Screen Actors Guild in Hollywood during the Red Scare. I'm not going to get into it because I happen to like his son, Ron Jr. But, The liberals in this country, the wealthy liberals, have utterly and absolutely failed. And they fail every day, every single goddamn day that goes by, that these people are not getting together in Denver or Washington or Seattle or someplace and sitting down and saying, we have got to do something. Every day that they're not doing that, which was yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, the battle is being lost. Does anyone really, in their right mind, where do you think the money comes from to pay Rush Limbaugh $50 million a year? Hello? Come on! Oh, advertising. No! Sorry! Where do you think the money comes from to run these think tanks, which is a complete misnomer? Where do you think the money comes from to run the Heritage Foundation? And where do you think, it just goes on and on and on. Because consortia of wealthy conservative neo-Nazis, proto-fascists got together and decided, look, we've had enough of this democracy crap. We've had enough of the challenge from the left. We've had enough of their weak-kneed, fey attempts to actually provide the energy to run a democratic republic. We are going to destroy them. Well, guess what? So, any anger I feel about the conservatives, I don't give a tinker's damn about conservatives except for the destruction that they have brought this country, they brought to this country and to the human race. But boy, I'll tell you, the liberals, the progressives, the ones who have constantly and consistently turned their back against every single plea for assistance. And I'm not talking about from my program or network someplace. I'm talking about every single plea for money for think tanks, for organizations to fight back, for media outlets. Damn all of you. You know what I'm saying? Because when it all goes down, unless you change your stripes, there's going to be no place for you to hide either, boobily. You know?
Unleaded regular, forget about supreme. We can't afford our gasoline. We can't afford our gasoline. The prices have become obscene. You'll get screwed at the pump, so bring your Vaseline. We can't afford our gasoline.
That hybrid car doesn't seem so queer after all.
We'll be right back.
No more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
Revolution. 21 past the hour. In about 10-12 minutes, we'll have a moment with Bob, which we haven't had for a while. We haven't had a moment with Bob. Bob Alexander, who's been busy trying to do his part to see that George W. Bush is indicted for murder, with his efforts with Vince Bugliosi and getting the book out. And what is it? ProsecuteGeorgeWBush.com is the website. But Bugliosi's book about how to prosecute what, Kathy? I couldn't hear you there.
The prosecution of George W. Bush
for murder, right. So that's why we haven't gotten a moment with Bob for a while. Let me see if I can say this right. Back to your phone calls. AJ, the music factory, is calling from the Catskills. Hey, AJ, where in the hell
are you? Hey, handsome, how are you?
Where you been? Haven't heard from you for a long time.
Well, you know, I after Obama won, I just needed a huge break.
Yeah?
Because I had been eating and sleeping and drinking the election for two solid years.
Oh, my God.
And really just, you know, on it all the time and wondering.
Sure.
The analogy that I gave is because, you know, the funny thing is I'm not a particularly political person, believe it or not. But the analogy I gave is that if suddenly you found out that there was a possibility that in 6 months an asteroid was going to hit the Earth and cause calamitous damage.
Right.
Chances are for 6 months you might be interested in astronomy. You know,
right.
Even though you weren't before and you won't be afterwards if it doesn't hit.
Right.
And so that's kind of how I felt about it. I really needed to see was this, you know, I mean, we were virtually had our bags packed.
If
McCain had won.
I
needed a break. And then, well, then you know the rest of the story. Christ, you disappeared. It was everything, the roof fell in.
No, I haven't disappeared.
Well, not disappeared, but excuse me, but you know, I mean, it was things were.
Well, things went crazy, but we managed to maintain thanks to a couple of people who got a couple of recorded Malloy programs from the now defunct Nova M, and played those. What was it, Kathy? Two nights, three nights, while we scrambled around to get the uplink to Westwood One to you know, see how much money we had in the bank, to see how long we could go. So no, we've been here, but you're right, the web the information that everybody got familiar with. How do you listen to Malloy Show if you listen online? Well, you go to Nova M. That's gone, long gone.
Exactly.
The only way to get the information now is to go to MikeMalloy.com, and it's all right there. So
and I would say, and I'm not a businessman in the radio field, so you guys would know better than I would. But I would say, stay this way. You know, this is. I congratulate you for finally being untethered.
Oh yeah. Oh, I completely agree. I am so sick of working for companies that can't get the financing, and that's no reflection on the people who ran them. They were desperate. I just went through a 5-minute rap about how rich liberals have let this completely die. Or companies that decided, well, let's get rid of Malloy and bring in Dr. Laura. You know, or like Air America, well, let's get rid of Malloy because we're cutting off all programming after 9 o'clock. Oh, we owe him $100,000. Ah, screw him. You know, his union won't do anything. And both of which turned out to be true.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm sick of it too, AJ. So now, we either sink or swim, fly or crash. We'll see. We'll know. You know, we'll just take this month to month. As we look ahead, though, I think it looks pretty promising. We've got some backing, not financial, but some backing, some expertise in the industry that is has agreed to help, and I think it just may work out. Go ahead.
Way back when all of this first started with Air America, and Air America was this one blade of grass that grew out of this dry plain.
Right.
Sam Cedar had said that this is a very good thing. There's no doubt about it. It's a very positive thing. He says, but progressive radio will really not come into its own until you have competing progressive markets, you know, competing against each other,
right.
And various people at various stages of projects and so forth. And I think now, maybe after the last four-ish years or 5 years, I think that was stage one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think now what's happened to you and a lot of other talk show hosts is kind of heralding something new. And I don't think you can rely on the sponsors. I think you're really going to have to go at it alone.
Well, I agree. And also the internet is going to be used much more vigorously.
Absolutely.
By us and by any liberal program that wants to maintain. It's going to have to be a huge chunk of it is going to have to be net based. Hey,
yeah.
Listen, AJ, there's the noise. I got to go. Listen,
thanks for your good work.
All right, don't be a stranger.
You betcha.
All right, thanks, AJ. We'll be back after the break. Stick around a moment with Bob.
Better stand back. Here come 50,000 watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. And now, ladies and gentlemen, once again, it's time for A Moment with Bob. Ah, yes. Once again, the Sage of Seattle. A Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. The title of Bob's moment tonight is What More Evidence Do We Need? Hey, Mike, just recently, Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School, wrote in the March issue of Harper's, quote, "We may not have realized it at the time, but in the period from late 2001 to January 19th, 2009, this country was a dictatorship," end quote. Horton's article was based upon a series of 9 previously secret legal opinions devised by Bush's Office of Legal Counsel, which were released by the Obama administration. John Dean observed on Keith Olbermann's program, quote, "Reading these memos, you've got to almost conclude we had an unconstitutional dictator. It's pretty deadly and pretty serious what's in these materials," end quote. And now, of course, Seymour Hersh has revealed that the military was running and, quote, "executive assassination ring throughout the Bush years, which reported directly to former Vice President Dick Cheney," end quote. Actually, I mean the CIA. Well, I can only respond to these latest Bush bombshells like Claude Rains did as Captain Renault in Casablanca. "I'm shocked, shocked to find that gambling is going on in here." Here's what we know. They lied us into a war, shredded the Constitution, sanctioned secret renditions, tortured and imprisoned people for years without being charged with any crime, killed over 1 million people, and looted the Treasury. And Cheney ran this century's version of Murder Incorporated. And Scott Horton writes, quote, "We may not have realized it at the time, but in the period from late 2001, January 19, this country was a dictatorship," end quote. Tonto replies, "Who's we, white man?" John Dean said, "You got to almost conclude we had an unconstitutional dictator." You think? Now, I realize that there's a big pile of stuporous Americans out there whose reaction times are a tad bit slower than your average flesh-eating zombie. But for Christ's sake, there were millions of Americans who did realize that we were living in a dictatorship during the Bush regime. What the hell else would you call it? Sure, most of us could travel as long as we weren't on the no-fly list. We could hop on over to Canada as long as we weren't members of Code Pink. The Bush regime would decide who deserved due process and who wouldn't. They decided who was an enemy combatant, not the rule of law. The rule of law was superseded by the Bush crime family. My dictionary's definition of dictatorship reads, a country, government, or the form of government in which absolute power is exercised by a dictator. And as described by Wikipedia, absolute power, as in political power, typically refers to concepts of tyranny, corruption, authoritarianism, and totalitarianism, and is associated largely with monarchy and non-democratic forms of government. The Supreme Court illegally handed the presidency to George W. Bush in 2000, and 4 years later, the election was stolen from the American people again. Sounds like a non-democratic form of government to me. No offense to John Dean or Scott Horton, but I think a lot of us realized what kind of government we did have. You know, the non-democratic one. But mainstream media and the opposition party collaborated with the Bush regime and tried to keep that unsavory little item a secret. And even if we realized the truth, what were we going to do about it? Protest? Write letters to who? Congressmen? Senators? The dark overlord of the universe, the son of Sam Dog, who? It didn't do any good, and the majority of Americans really didn't care anyway. You see, as long as the majority of us aren't herded up and ground up into cat food, it's pretty comfortable living in the belly of the beast, if you don't know any better. We've got crappy health care, our food and water isn't completely poisoned, our jobs are hanging by a fraying thread, and by the end of the year, 2.4 million homes will be in foreclosure. That's over 46,000 homes every week. The last time the Republican crime machine ran roughshod over the country, they managed to pull off the biggest financial swindle in U.S. history, the savings and loan crime spree. It's possible that little scam will force taxpayers to pay interest on those bailout bonds to the tune of $13 billion a year forever. Just for fun, you might want to read the definitive book about the looting of America's savings and loans, Inside Job, by Stephen Pitzo, Mary Fricker, and Paul Muolo. Inside Job is the title. After a respite during the Clinton years, the Republican crime machine came roaring back to power. This time, they weren't even elected. Using 9/11 as a trigger, they started a couple of wars, killed over a million people, and stole everyone's money, and the next generation's money, and the next. And we're still not finished killing. We've got years of death waiting in the Iraq and Afghanistan pipelines. I guess I should cheer up. We've got brand new administration promising transparency and accountability. Senator Leahy has proposed a toothless truth commission to investigate the misdeeds of the Bush regime. When President Obama was asked if he agreed with such a proposal, he responded, quote, "My view is also that nobody's above the law. And if there are clear instances of wrongdoing, that people should be prosecuted just like any ordinary citizen. But that, generally speaking, I'm more interested in looking forward than I am in looking backward. So I will take a look at Senator Leahy's proposal, but my general orientation is to say, let's get it right moving forward," end quote. I don't think Barack Obama has seen enough horror films. Doesn't he know that the monsters keep coming back? The only way to get it right moving forward is to recognize that there were monsters in the first place. You have to name them, investigate them, indict them, put them on trial, and tell the people what they've done. Let the jury decide if they are guilty or not. If they are found guilty, put them away. That's how it's done. Anything else leaves options for the monsters and their zombie-like followers to come back. As Inside Job, the book, concluded, quote, "But perhaps most dangerous of all was the willingness of honest people to tolerate, rationalize, and even do business with the crooks. As a respected Nevada judge said, it won't be the bad people who destroy this country. It will be the good people who rationalize the bad people's conduct. Regards, Bob." Another Moment with Bob. Brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. And we will wait with great anticipation and furious... No, what's the rest of that? Furious anger. As a matter of fact, if you got that handy, we don't do polkas. I'm just too damn tired to do a polka, but I sure would like to hear Ezekiel. What is it? Ezekiel 20... what is it? Ezekiel...
Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men.
Amen.
Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper.
Amen.
And the finder of lost children.
Hallelujah!
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord.
Woo!
When I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Ah! Ah! You go, Samuel! Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, I lost my head there. It's just something about that form of justice that is so pure, so legitimate, so righteous. Back to your phone calls. Chris is calling from Madison, Wisconsin, listening, of course, on 92.1 The Mic. Hey, Chris.
Hey, I'm equally tired and equally as obnoxiously insane as you are tonight. So I wanted to give you kind of a group hug.
Oh, thank you.
And then I wanted to say, I have a positive Rachel Carson story. I was standing out on my deck. I live on a DNR protected wildlife area. I was standing out on my deck last week.
Let me interrupt. You mean Rachel Corey?
What?
You mean Rachel Corey?
No, Rachel Carson.
Rachel Carson, the one that wrote Silent Spring.
Yes.
Okay.
I was standing out on my deck, and four bald eagles flew right over my head. And I was talking to my sister on the phone, and I elated an expletive because I have never seen them that closely. And if Rachel Carson had been who she had been, the symbol of our nation would not be flying over my duck. So
that's very true. That's absolutely true. Chris, let me put you on hold for a second because we've got to do some commercials here, but we'll come back as soon as we're finished. I think Kathy has to talk about night skin. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Idea what I'm going to do this weekend. Oh, yeah. 10 before the hour. Thanks to Kathy Bay, Ben Burt, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Bruce Enberg, and Kathy Bay for executive producing all of it, including herself. That's the Malloy program staff. How many people on that list now are paid? Well, actually, only one. Well, no, actually, nobody at this point. Whoa! It's so much fun. It is indeed. Chris is calling from Madison. We started talking, didn't we? I'm sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
Now. I want to go all the way back to what you were talking about in the beginning, and then I have a story about liberal fascism for you.
Okay, as long as you can do it in 3.5 minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
I have a friend who works for the World Health Organization, and what he does is he goes into third world countries. I can talk really fast. He goes into third world countries, and he distributes. He goes into clinics. And, oh, I have ninja cats in the background. He goes into third world countries, and he distributes contraceptive devices and packages with syringes in them and all that kind of stuff and teaches the doctors and nurses how. He said the number one problem that they have is that the Jesus people are over there telling people that their penises are going to fall off if they use a condom.
Right. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, right. So the AIDS epidemic in Africa is because of the Jesus people, which is somewhat ironic, I think.
Yeah.
But they don't think about that. Now I have a story about liberal fascism to tell you, and I will tell you just the 3-minute version of this story because it's a very, very long story. I have been battling liberal fascism in the state of Wisconsin for 24 years, and I deserve a pat on the back for having continued with this fight. I lost everything I ever worked for in my adult life to a rich liberal fascist and her manipulation of the government in the state of Wisconsin. And they took my house away from me and all of my belongings, everything. My work, I'm a painter. By work, and I found out that they are laundering really, really dirty money, the bell curve money, Bradley money, through the specious nonprofit that they operate into the coffers of people like the lieutenant governor of the state of Wisconsin. And my life has been threatened twice. Like I said, I deserve a pat on the back for continuing with this story. But I think that we need to understand that this stuff is going on. This is not all the Democrats are clean and all the Republicans are dirty and the liberals are not involved in this up to their eyeballs with this kind of stuff. And
well, let me just interrupt respectfully.
Okay.
If people who identify themselves as liberals are doing this sort of thing, then obviously, of course, they are not liberals.
Exactly.
So my point being that real liberals don't do this kind of stuff. There's only one political class that does this, and that is the conservatives / neo-fascists. I just maintain that a lot of people may, for whatever reason, call themselves liberals or progressives, but they're not.
I know. It's just about manipulating money and power and getting their fingers into things where they can control everything, and one has to wonder about their mental state. But I just...
Uh-oh. I think her cell phone was... I think that's what that noise was. I think Chris's cell phone was dying. So we'll talk again, Chris. I hate technology. I am becoming a true Luddite. And I hate that. You know, my son has an iPhone that is really my God, this thing will do everything up to and including provide a minimal amount of a fairly decent stimulation if you're really into that. No, I'm serious. It does everything. It's a computer. And you know, no matter where he is. And he was telling me the other day when we were visiting him and his wife, he said, you know, Pop, you're going to have to get in the loop here. And I said, look, Chris, I hate, not Chris I was just talking to, but Chris, my son. I said, look, you know, I'm coming to the point where I really do hate technology. I do. I guess that means your dad is getting old because it just, most of it pisses me off. It is so dehumanizing. And they said, no, it's not. Let me tell you about Facebook. Let me tell you about MySpace. I said, no. Let me tell you, do you Twitter, Dad? I said, no. I get all kinds of requests. Every day in my email, I open up invitations to become someone's friend. I said, you know, I didn't really know what that meant. I thought people were saying, do you want to be my friend? And I'm like, Jesus, Kathy, what is this? Why are people saying this? And Kathy very patiently said, no, Mike, it's not about being your friend. It's, you know, so she explained it to me. And no, I, you know, there's not enough hours in the day right now just to open the damn email and try to respond to as many as possible, the ones that make it through the filter. And all that because Chris's, the Chris phone caller's phone was beeping. I don't know. I have a lot of friends now, probably you do too, that don't even bother with telephone landlines. It's all, you know, it's all cell phone. Oh, really, Mike? That's been going on for about 6 years now. But it's all a mystery to me. All right, listen, we're about out of time. I hope you have a great weekend. The jonquils are starting to bloom here in Atlanta, which means it won't be long until the dogwoods and all these beautiful flowers and bushes start to flower here. It's wonderful, unless you have allergies, and then you might as well have, you know, gone to hell. Because this is the time of year when the pollen count here in Atlanta, a lot of pollen is 100. Our pollen count usually goes up to around 6,000. Anyway, we'll see you Monday night, and Tuesday we'll actually have phone service so we can actually take calls. So have a great weekend, all right? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Oh, yeah, have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are, dude.